You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2026 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. We begin with a Vanity Fair spotlight shooting star. Since joining the New York Knicks in 2022, Jalen Brunson has been the quiet force behind the team's renaissance, transforming them from a franchise that was synonymous with disappointment and incompetence to one that has the potential to bring home the city's first NBA championship since the 70s. Tom Clute speaks to New York's most beloved athlete about his rise from role player to rock star and whether the Knicks can really win it all this year. Photographs by Quentin DeBry. Opening photo shows Brunson reclining in bed, holding a basketball. Jalen Brunson sips his chamomile tea and ponders a question that still feels strange to ask. Are the New York Knicks good enough to win it all? Brunson, the team's captain and unquestioned star, does not exactly sound like someone planning a ticker tape parade. We got a lot of work to do, he says, his voice taking on the stern register of a concerned parent. Brunson speaks carefully, as if weighing how candid to be. He mentions the Knicks' uneven road record and laments a lack of sharpness on the margins. Then he pauses, collects his thoughts, and offers what feels like a sobering assessment of a team that, at the time, sits only a few games out of first place. We are very gifted. We are very talented, Brunson says. But we need the little things that help us be better, the intangibles. We got to that point last year where we had it. We don't have it right now. Brunson lives by an unforgiving standard, one that propelled his rise and reset expectations for what he and the Knicks can achieve. Currently in his fourth season with the team, Brunson stands as the city's most beloved athlete of the moment. Both the Post and the Times, in rare bipartisan alignment, have anointed him the King of New York, while his number 11 jersey has become a kind of civic uniform across the five boroughs. Fans of all ages swarm for autographs and selfies, or maybe just to say thanks, whenever he braves the hordes of Manhattan. He even garnered 27 write-in votes in last year's mayoral election, 29 if you include the ballots that misspelled his name, and earned a shout-out in Zoran Mamdani's inauguration speech. In a city full of naysayers, Brunson somehow appears to have none at all. He's been the perfect guy to come to New York, says Ben Stiller, a lifelong Knicks fan. That sentiment has more to do with substance than showmanship. The Jalen Brunson experience is not characterized by flash, and he has achieved rock star status without ever acting like one. A crafty southpaw, Brunson has an old man game, one built on deft footwork, a soft touch around the basket, pump fakes, and post-ups. He is a prolific scorer, but his highlight reel is perhaps not quite as scintillating as one featuring, say, Anthony Edwards. Brunson's playing style, all efficiency and economy, mirrors his understated demeanor. His father once quipped that his son is boring as shit to interview. His low-key vibe may seem off-brand for a New York icon, but Brunson's improbable journey to stardom and workmanlike approach have endeared him to the city like few others. He's always been an underdog, Stiller says. New Yorkers love that. Most of all, though, they love Brunson for the central role he's played in the Knicks' renaissance, transforming the team from a byword for dysfunction into one typified by competence. He has completely changed the perception and direction of a single franchise, and he's done it in New York, which is not easy to do, says Mike Breen, the longtime Eastman play-by-play announcer and voice of Knicks broadcast. He's in the conversation to be one of the greatest Knicks of all time, and he's done it in 3+ years. Mamdani, with signature rhetorical flourish, describes Brunson as every New Yorker who's been told that they are not enough, but has proven that the greatness of this city belongs to all of us. Jalen Brunson was never supposed to be a superstar, and that's what makes him ours, Mamdani adds. He found in New York a place he could call home and came to match the greatness of the city he wears across his chest. He is one of us. The sun shines brighter over Madison Square Garden these days, especially during the playoffs, when long-dormant expectation creeps back in. Those moments have a way of revealing players, and Brunson has won over fans by routinely rising to them, a quality that gives him an edge in the local hierarchy over Aaron Judge, the Herculean Yankees slugger with an unfortunate habit of saving his worst performances for October. Judge, for what it's worth, received just 11 write-in votes for mayor. Last season, Brunson was naming the NBA's Clutch Player of the Year, named the NBA's Clutch Player of the Year, which he later backed up with a smooth game-winning 3 to eliminate the Detroit Pistons in the first round of the playoffs. Stiller, like a true diehard, still revisits that play from time to time. There's something about the guy that has affected more than just winning, says Stiller. His personality, his story, his work ethic, all of that is so perfectly New York. Having the Knicks back in contention feels just as right. New York, home of Rucker Park, proving ground for Kareem, point guard Holy Land, is a basketball town and one of the sport's true capitals. Brunson has restored that patrimony, bringing the roar back to the Garden in April and May. Next photo, Great Expectations. Jalen Brunson received the message from fans and the front office, it's time to win now. And in this photo, Brunson stands on the court, his right arm extended upward with his hand pointing in the number one gesture. The team beat the Orlando Magic and then the San Antonio Spurs to win the in-season NBA Cup in December. After winning just one playoff series in the 2 decades before his arrival, the Knicks have advanced past the first round in each of the last 3. Last year, Brunson took them further than they've been in a quarter century, reaching the conference finals for the first time since Bill Clinton was president. When the Knicks go on a run like that, New York feels smaller, shrinking from a sprawling metropolis to a college town where everyone wears the same colors and spills onto the streets after a home win. The fans were so hungry for somebody to lead them out of the darkness and to have some sort of success after so many rough years, says Breen. Here comes this kid, and he provides that. But the happy-to-be-there vibes have given way to loftier expectations. Their appetite for postseason basketball now satisfied, the Knicks faithful have grown peckish for more. The team entered this season with its strongest roster since the 90s, when Pat Riley prowled the sideline and Patrick Ewing manned the paint. Fans who have known little more than disappointment are now indulging dreams of seeing the Knicks win their first championship since 1973. That optimism extends to the top of the organization. In January, owner James Dolan laid down his marker, saying in a local radio interview that the team absolutely has to reach the finals this year. Brunson, carrying the gaze and hopes of an entire city, understands the assignment. We're definitely in win-now mode, he says. Our front office has put a lot into this organization, and it's our team. They're basically saying it's win-now mode, so we got to do our best to win now. I meet Brunson at the Roaster Cafe, a cozy Turkish-inspired spot near his home in the Tony Westchester suburbs. He and his wife, Ali, are regulars, though they usually stop in during quieter hours. On the Saturday after Thanksgiving, the cafe hums with brunch-goers who greet Brunson with nods and knowing smiles as he makes his way to a table beneath a flat screen that displays a crackling holiday fireplace. "You're a hell of a player," a man says in passing. Standing at 6 feet two, with a low, compact build, Brunson arrives in a weekend uniform, sky-blue Nike hoodie with Ray-Bans dangling from the collar, black sweatpants, and a matching beanie pulled low over his rounded head. Even with generational wealth and a place on the city's A-list, the 29-year-old Brunson insists convincingly that he has not shed the no-frills mantle of an everyman. "It's not like my lifestyle is different," he says. "You see where I came to meet you. I'm a regular guy who goes to a local coffee shop to grab tea or coffee or whatever. It doesn't change the way I live." As he speaks, Brunson glances briefly at his phone. He has missed a call from Josh Hart, his former college teammate and closest friend on the Knicks. Off the court, the two host a podcast, Roommates Show, a fairly standard athlete-led gab fest featuring interviews with teammates, coaches, and other NBA figures. Brunson guesses the call was about a planned double date with their wives. "You would think we'd get tired of each other," Brunson says. "Our wives will be like, 'You guys just saw each other,' and we're like, 'Yeah, and?'" On their podcast and in post-game press conferences, they sometimes resemble a buddy cop duo, with Brunson typically playing the role of exasperated straight man. "I'm kind of the more unfiltered guy, and will just say what I think," Hart says. "He's a little more political." Brunson's mother, Sandra, puts it a bit differently. "Jalen and I are alike in the sense that we are very methodical and intentional," she says. "We think things through before we react." There is something wholesome about Brunson's existence, his orbit populated by family and longtime friends. He and Allie, who gave birth to their daughter Jordan in July 2024, were high school sweethearts in Greater Chicago. His father Rick, a former NBA journeyman, is now one of his Knicks coaches, while Sandra serves as chief financial officer of his foundation. Even his professional team is anchored by day ones. His younger sister, Erica, and his best friend since eighth grade, Connor Keshaw, handle his marketing responsibilities. "If you are in our circle, Jalen will have your back no matter what," says Allie, a physical therapist with her own practice. "He puts family first. He is intense that way." Brunson says his crew keeps him humble and level-headed, never too high or too low. "Someone like Keshaw," he notes, "won't just say yes or say the things I want to hear." Few keep him more grounded than his dad, and if working with a parent sounds like torture, well, sorry, Brunson can't relate. "He holds me accountable every single day, even when I don't want to be talked to. At the time, I hate it. I'll say something back," Brunson says. "But he's right, and I listen to him. It's the best thing for me. I know when he's being a dad, and I know when he's being a coach." Rick had never coached his son on an official basis before joining the Knicks staff, but Jalen's childhood revolved around intense training sessions with his old man. The video that went viral a few years ago offered a glimpse into what that was like. In a scene straight out of He Got Game, the clip shows a young, increasingly exhausted Jalen performing a series of grueling drills while Rick, off-camera, gruffly demands more effort. "Everything you do has to be legit," the elder Brunson says at one point in the video. "He was very tough," Jalen says, "but he would ask me all the time, 'Is this what you want to do for a living?' And the answer was always yes. I wasn't being forced to play basketball. He knew this is what I wanted to do. He played in the NBA, so he had the blueprint for what it takes." Rick played for eight different teams across his nine-year NBA career, including two stints with the Knicks between 1999 and 2001. That era, highlighted by the franchise's last appearance in the NBA Finals, is memorialized with photos of a toddler-aged Jalen sporting Knicks gear and posing on the garden hardwood. The early immersion in the league environment had an osmosis-like effect on Jalen, as it often does for an athlete's kid. But it was the exposure to his father's grind that left the deepest impression. For Rick, minutes were scarce, and a roster spot never guaranteed. Mere survival in the NBA hinged on out-hustling his competition. I think it got so deep in his brain, like, damn, I have to work that hard just to achieve my dream, says Rick, and it just stuck with him. That work ethic and intensity were immediately apparent to Jay Wright, Brunson's coach at Villanova. On a recruiting visit during Brunson's senior year of high school, Wright was left speechless when he saw the young prospect's bedroom walls adorned with quotes from the likes of Aristotle and Marcus Aurelius, along with newspaper clippings of games he lost. I was blown away, Wright says. He's the perfect balance between his mom and his father. His father had the mental toughness and commitment level on the court, and his mom had the wisdom, the stoicism, the spirituality. On the spectrum of New York sporting legends, Brunson skews more toward Eli than Broadway Joe. He builds with Legos and listens to Justin Bieber. Along the star-studded celebrity row at the Garden, where Stiller, Spike Lee, and Timothy Chalamet are fixtures, Brunson usually scans first for Mariska Hargitay, the star of Law & Order Special Victims Unit, his favorite show. In interviews, his sound bites fall somewhere between measured and monotone. Rick likens his son's interactions with the media to those of Bill Belichick, the legendary football coach and master of the monosyllabic press conference. That's probably a bit harsh, and Brunson's friends and family, including Rick, are quick to push back against the idea that he's dull. Beneath the stone-faced exterior, they say, is someone who is secretly hilarious. He's not a stick in the mud, says Sandra. I'll just say that. Brunson is, according to his dad, probably the biggest clown on the team. He has such a stoic face on the court, you'd think he doesn't enjoy the game or enjoy life, says Rick, but he's one of the funniest guys. Hart agrees. He's a goof. He plays around nonstop, he says. But when we get on the court, it's a total switch-up, and he goes into more of a killer mentality. Next photo, on point. Brunson plays pool on December 12th at the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas. Brunson's sense of humor typically takes the form of well-honed deadpan, often aimed at Hart. He showcased that side in December during a post-game interview with the Prime Video studio crew, turning a playful question into a perfectly timed zinger. When asked about his showing in the mayoral election, Brunson didn't miss a beat. Roasting his buddy who had recently been robbed of $185,000 worth of jewelry. If I was mayor, whoever stole Josh's watches in New York City, Brunson said, I would make sure they walk free. Brunson is no bore, but he is perhaps a bit of a normie. For someone like him, it can be awkward living in a kingdom of admirers. At the cafe, he recalled an encounter after signing with the team when someone asked if he was the Knicks' savior. I'm like, I'm not a savior in any way, shape, or form, Brunson says. I'm just going to do my best to contribute to this team and to help them win. In truth, few believed the Knicks were getting a franchise savior when he signed, and even fewer predicted stardom coming out of college. Brunson entered the league in 2018 after a highly decorated career at Villanova. In three seasons, he won two NCAA championships and a string of individual honors, culminating in National Player of the Year recognition. But most analysts projected a more modest NBA career, questioning whether he had the speed and athleticism to thrive in the pros. One scouting report pegged him as a high-end backup. For most of his four seasons with the Dallas Mavericks, who drafted him in the second round, that description fit. There, he became a key part of the supporting cast around Luka Doncic, the Slovenian virtuoso selected 30 picks before Brunson. My role in Dallas was different from my role now, he says. Everyone thinks, oh, he wasn't the same player, he wasn't this. No, my role was different. As a good teammate and leader, you have to understand where you are and your role on the team. Still, Brunson offered hints that he could reach another level. During the 2021-22 season, he emerged as one of the Mavericks' best players, becoming their third leading scorer while securing a starting role in the playoffs with Doncic sidelined. Brunson erupted against the Utah Jazz, including a 41-point performance in Game 2. Brunson became a free agent that summer after Dallas failed to sign him to an extension. The Knicks, leaning on personal ties, made no secret of their interest. Weeks before free agency, they hired Rick Brunson as an assistant on Tom Thibodeau's staff, a familiar arrangement for Rick, who had played for and coached under Thibodeau. Other connections were already in place. Knicks president Leon Rose, a former agent at CAA, had long represented the Brunson family, first signing Rick as his inaugural client and later representing Jalen. The bond between the families runs deep. Jalen counts Rose's daughter Brooke among his closest friends, and Rose's son Sam is now part of his cadre of agents. After Jalen was born, while Rick was playing overseas, Rose helped pick up the slack. He saw me before my dad did, Jalen says. Brunson eventually agreed to a four-year, $104 million deal with New York, driven by a desire to build his own legacy. At the time of free agency, I was thinking about all the situations, he says. Could I be comfortable and stay in a role next to a future Hall of Famer, or create my own path? I was never afraid to fail. When you're reaching for your dreams, you've got to take leaps, even if it's uncomfortable. The decision left Dallas's front office bristling. Mark Cuban, the former majority owner of the Mavericks, publicly complained that the team never had a real chance to retain Brunson and that talks went south when his father got involved. Brunson disputes that, maintaining that the Mavericks absolutely had an opportunity to keep him. While he and Cuban later cleared the air on Brunson's podcast, tension lingered. The NBA docked the Knicks a second-round draft pick for tampering in their courtship of Brunson, a penalty Cuban says should have been far worse. Brunson, for his part, has moved on. So, too, apparently, has Cuban, who declined to comment further. Ultimately, the Mavericks could have offered Brunson more money, but didn't. Even if they had, the Knicks presented him with something else. When the Knicks made an offer to him, I looked at him and told him, "This team is giving you an opportunity," recalls Sandra. "They're saying they believe in you. You can bet on yourself." Brunson's arrival in New York was not widely seen as transformative, with most viewing him as a reliable lieutenant rather than a franchise pillar. Some commentators even argued the Knicks had overpaid. "I was a little bit skeptical of this move," Stiller admits. But Brunson quickly silenced the doubters. He went from 16 points per game in Dallas to 24 in his first year with the Knicks. By season two in New York, he was averaging nearly 29 points per game, shouldering the bulk of the offense and earning all NBA honors. This season, he is putting together a characteristically stellar campaign, earning a starting spot in the All-Star game for the second straight year, and affirming his reputation as one of the league's best players. What he's done, Breen says, is one of the all-time transformations. Even some of Brunson's strongest backers admit they didn't expect all of that. "I thought that he would be a great point guard to have on a championship-level team with other great players," says Wright, who retired in 2022. "I thought he could be one of three, not one of one." Brunson stepped seamlessly into the role of franchise player, and the Knicks responded accordingly, treating him like one of the league's most firmly entrenched stars, even more so, it turns out, than Doncic was in Dallas. Under Rose, The team has built a roster to highlight Brunson's strengths, most visibly in the acquisition of three of Brunson's former Villanova teammates, Hart, Dante DiVincenzo, and Michael Bridges. The Nova Knicks synced neatly with Brunson's family-first entourage, but the same loyalty that governs his life off the court is in short supply in the NBA. Rose, in particular, has proven willing to make tough, even cutthroat decisions. Just before last season, the Knicks completed a blockbuster trade, sending DiVincenzo and Julius Randle to the Minnesota Timberwolves, along with a 2025 first-round pick, in exchange for Karl-Anthony Towns, a former Rose client. And following its best postseason showing in a generation, the team fired Thibodeau and replaced him with Mike Brown. Both moves were awkward for Brunson. DiVincenzo was a groomsman in his wedding, and he has known Thibodeau since childhood. Brunson says he wasn't consulted on the DiVincenzo trade, though he got a heads up shortly before it went public, which apparently suits him just fine. He maintains a church and state approach to front office decisions, saying it makes him uncomfortable to get involved. "It's not for me to put my 2 cents in on another man's livelihood," Brunson says. "One of my best friends was getting traded, and so I can't sit there and be like, yeah, trade my best friend or trade Julius." The Thibodeau firing, he says, was also tough. "It was just off," Brunson tells me. "It was a weird situation, because there's this person who I've known for so long, who's helped me, and then I see him go. It's sad, but it's the business. Sometimes you've got to leave the personal stuff out of it." Franchise players are rarely kept entirely out of personnel matters, particularly the type the Knicks executed the past 2 years. When I pressed him to elaborate on his level of involvement, Brunson acknowledged that he offers his perspective when asked, but stressed that he leaves his fingerprints off the final decisions. "The front office has the vision, and it's on us as players to go out and do our job. Yes, I'm asked about stuff, but I remove myself from that," he says. "I'll say something, but I'm not going to be incriminating or say, this is what you should do. I'll give my pros and cons." While management has built a roster to complement him, Brunson has reciprocated. In 2024, he signed a 4-year, $156.5 million extension, a dizzying sum, yet well short of the 5-year, $269 million deal he could have gotten had he waited a year. There were clear reasons he took the bag, as he puts it. Waiting for the bigger contract carried risk, with an injury potentially jeopardizing the payday. "I've seen players wait and then get hurt, and then they're at the mercy of the organization," he says. Brunson, ever the pragmatist, preferred not to take that chance. "If I'm thinking about playing well to make sure I get paid, that could mess with me," he says. "I play best when I have a free mind, and that did that for me. A lot of people say I sacrificed for the team. 100% I sacrificed for the team. But most importantly, I made sure my family and I are taken care of." Brunson's $113 million discount provided the Knicks with precious cap flexibility, but come 2028, he will be eligible for a 5-year, $417.8 million deal. He will be 32 entering that season, an age when smaller guards often show signs of decline. But Brunson is hopeful the Knicks will reward his team-friendly extension. "Obviously, we'd love for them to do right by me," Brunson says. "I think anyone would. I feel like I sacrificed." As Brunson nurses his chamomile, a server appears bearing an unexpected tribute. "This is from us," she says, setting down a small plate with 2 pieces of baklava on the house. The royal treatment takes many forms. Less than 24 hours earlier, he had been serenaded with MVP chants in a Black Friday win at the Garden over the Milwaukee Bucks in the NBA Cup, the league's fledgling in-season tournament. Brunson was masterful, scoring 37 points, and sealing the victory with a tough floater late in the fourth quarter. He drew a foul on the shot, which is typical. What came next was not. After the ball plunged through the net, Brunson let out a roar, strutted across the baseline, and headbutted the padded backstop beneath the hoop. "It was just there," he says with a shrug. "It felt like the time to do it." Our conversation winds down, and Brunson looks ahead to a quieter day, getting his hair braided, then dinner with neighbors. "His off days vary," he says, "but I make sure I'm not doing too much." In the weeks that followed, the Knicks displayed the consistency Brunson had been chasing, capped by an NBA Cup title that cemented their status as Eastern Conference favorites. But the new year brought a major dip in form, casting doubt on their championship credentials and underscoring the concerns Brunson had raised back in November. The team dropped 8 of its first 10 games in January, a stretch that hit its nadir with a lopsided home loss to Dallas on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. That performance drew boos from the Garden crowd and prompted Brunson to call a players-only meeting, a time-honored ritual for a season gone sideways. Knicks fans, no strangers to letdowns, put their rare bottle of optimism back on the shelf, unsure whether it will be uncorked for the playoffs. For now, though, Brunson's hold on the throne remains firm. He finishes his baklava and gathers his things. As he turns toward the front door of the cafe, a young woman stops him and bashfully asks for a photo. She addresses him as Mr. Brunson and says she is from the Bronx. Then just before they pose for the camera, she speaks for an entire city. "You mean so much to New York," she tells him. Sensori Uncensored. When Australian architect Bianca Sensori appears in public, often nude, always silent, she never fails to shock. Is it art? Is it abuse? Is it love? Kanye West's wife tells Anna Peel her own story, from her all-consuming art project to rehab in Spain to this moment when she decided it was time to speak for herself. Photographs by Katie Grannon. Opening photo shows Bianca Sensori riding a black horse, nude and with her long hair covering her body. Bianca Sensori says she's done being naked. In her 3 years of public life since she married the artist formerly known as Kanye West, Sensori's nudity had become ostentatious. When I note that yesterday, the first time we'd met in person, Sensori's sheer bodysuit and lack of bra exposed her nipples, she says, that to me is basically not nudity. Undress has not been a new or public-facing endeavor. I had an obvious obsession with nudity, the 31-year-old Australian says. We are in a quiet room upstairs from the space in which her first clothed art show will take place in Seoul in December. Ye, as he's now legally known, is there too, but is laying low. Sensori suggests to keep the spotlight of the show and this story on his wife. Until now, she says, I was naked everywhere. I didn't detach with it at any point. I consistently showed the same imagery over and over and over again, Sensori explains. I live my artwork. Sensori's nakedness has been fully literal. Confection as clothing in the form of a hard candy string bikini as she wore for a business meeting about the planning of Biopop, the first installment of a 7-year performance art project that she is in Korea to debut. Or when the world saw, thanks to paparazzi photos, her bare shoulders during a private moment with Ye in the back of a Venetian motorboat. Or most memorably, on the Grammys red carpet last February, Sensori stepped out of the limo, turned away from the cameras, and dropped her black Galliano fur to the floor to reveal herself in a nearly invisible mesh dress, sewn onto Sensori by future Maison Margiela couturier Simon Carl. Sensori hadn't planned for this to be the climax of her nudity project, but she'd been working on a film with Ye and the artist Vanessa Beecroft. A few days before the Grammys, they happened to come across the illusion fabric that actors wear in places like the back of backless gowns to keep them in place. Her multi-year process of disrobing was complete. In 2025, Bianca Sensori was the most Googled woman in the entire world, which Sensori requests I point out to the editor of Vanity Fair in a bid for the cover. I'm trying not to sound like I'm bragging, but it is not a position that anybody in time has ever had that much visibility without speech, Sensori says. If it was just nudity, a lot of people would have that. But it also proves in a time that was so overexposed and vulnerable that mystery still has power. She's right that her nakedness may not be the only reason for her incredible search volume, but the other reasons are not such a mystery. In the only in-depth interview she's ever given, Sensori is finally speaking about all that nudity, about her childhood and her early career, about her husband's mental health and apparent anti-Semitism, and about who exactly is in control of her life. Last February, the official channels to Sensori ran through her husband's company, Yeezy, where Sensori leads the architecture department, and through Milo Yiannopoulos, a far-right provocateur who had worked on Ye's 2024 presidential campaign. But after the Grammys moment, I took an educated guess at her personal email address and made contact. She agreed to a call to talk about her art, and we spoke for the first time a few weeks later. The conversations continued. Over months, the woman who calls herself Bianca the Elusive Unicorn, Bianca, as she pronounces her own name, her Australian accent elongating vowels into dip and trip thongs, as in Bianca, eventually explained much more. At the time, it was widely reported that Sensori was thinking of leaving Ye amid a deluge of horrifying behavior. And possibly, or so the leering speculation of tabloids and comments section goes, abuse of Sensori herself. 5 days after the Grammys, Ye posted, "I'm a Nazi" on X, which he followed up with the message, "I have dominion over my wife. This ain't no woke as feminist shit. She's with a billionaire." And that was all written in all caps. 2 days after that, Ye ran a Super Bowl commercial directing people to his website, Yeezy.com, where he began selling T-shirts with swastikas on them. If Sensori's project was provoking the world by showing everything while saying nothing, Ye's was saying everything, a lot of which was very, very bad. In January of this year, he apologized, and the trajectory of Sensori's story and this story changed yet again. Sensori knows that friends who don't have visibility into her frequently peripatetic life, before Korea, she'd been in L.A., Australia, and Japan, see her only in tabloid photos, or wordless and nude in the background of footage of her billionaire husband and his coterie of colleagues, friends, enablers. Like much of the public, these friends wonder whether she has consent in her public art, or if Ye is puppeteering the display of her body. They want to know whether she is silent because she has not been allowed to speak. They want to ask, what I first did a year ago, is she okay? "I don't really care," Sensori says of what we make of her. "I always just think they'll get it someday, and if they don't, they don't. As long as I'm able to express myself to my full potential, that's all that matters to me." Each other's skin. Before Sensori became the most Googled woman in the world, she was a precocious little girl in Melbourne. Her parents, who are still married, have 3 children. Bianca, her younger sister Angelina, and a brilliant brother who does not want to be part of this Michigas. The family was super Greek Orthodox, Sensori says, noting that she's still very religious. When Sensori was a child, she would read books of factoids so she'd have something to say about any topic that arose. "People would bring something up, and then I'd know something about that topic of information," she says accurately. "I'm a researcher, and factual also." Sensori's father, who had been convicted on heroin possession and firearm charges before Sensori was born, owned a fleet of claw machines successful enough to send his middle-class children to private school. "Amusement machines are better than having a place that collects rent," he would tell his daughter. Sensori knew the games were suspiciously impossible to win, but one day she decided she must have Baloo, the pear-shaped bear from the Jungle Book. Though her father could have simply opened the door and given her the toy, she sat in front of the machine for 8 hours until she got him, then promptly added him to the 50-odd other plushies on her bed. "They slept with me because I felt like they had feelings," she says. If one fell on the floor in the night, Sensori would wake up bereft. She still occasionally carries stuffed animals around, but according to her, it's now for effect. Sensori says she has always been guided by overwhelming emotion. Her parents had to remove the phone in their living room because she would incessantly call her father at work, demanding to know when he was coming home. If the clock went 1 minute past the ETA, Sensori would ring him back. "You're a liar," she'd yell. "You're not here. Why would you do that to me?" "I wasn't able to regulate for my whole life," Sensori says. "I also pair bond so intensely and so deeply that that person becomes part of me. That's my person. You know that movie Together, where they're getting into each other's skin? I loved that one. That's kind of who I am." In the 2025 film, actors and real-life spouses Alison Brie and Dave Franco slowly fuse into a single being. This depth of feeling tracks with how Sensori describes nearly every relationship. As a girl, she would sit by the fence and wail when she couldn't be with her young neighbor. Of her husband, she continually repeats, "I love him. I love him so much." When we part, she tells me she feels like she made a friend. "It's only ever brought joy to my life," she says of codependency. "I just love that person so deeply, so intensely, that I want to be around them." Next photos, skin in the game. Censori starring in her art film titled Bianca. Stepping out at a Grammys after party in 2025. On a family trip in Japan. Bearing it all with Ye on the Grammys red carpet. An installment of Biopop, her seven-year art project that debuted in Korea last year. Censori apparently got the highest grades for art in her high school graduating class, one of the only things her mother, Alexandra, nervous and wearing a faux fur coat, feels comfortable revealing to me when we meet in Korea after Censori's show. After considering majoring in sculpture, Censori entered the University of Melbourne's architecture program, where she got bachelor's and then master's degrees. College, she says, was one of the most difficult periods of her life. "I like when something feels intense, horrible, scary, all that sort of stuff," she says, "because there's growth on the other side." Censori alternated between being exorcism-level upset while overworking on assignments and getting deep in context, like a study abroad in Manila, where she learned about sustainable housing. Kneeling on the sofa, Censori becomes extremely animated as she explains that, because of inadequate housing there, a large percentage of the homes in the city are part of informal settlements. Since a handful of families own all of Manila's land, these communities aren't protected by anything other than de facto tenure, unofficial temporary possession of an area. If the landowners want their space back, they will often give the people living there enough money to move somewhere less expensive, but far from their work and communities. This monologue on housing theory was a roundabout way of explaining a photo of Censori with her mother, aunt, and sister, in which Censori looks like the daughter of a real housewife of New Jersey, with a clementine tan and leopard print bustier. I had asked about the dissonant image of Censori, and she breezed past the picture itself, which was taken at a wedding that Censori attended after returning from Manila. What I'd wanted to talk about was that the photo seems to date to a liminal period when Bianca the Civilian ended and Bianca the Unicorn began. The elusive unicorn. Starting as an undergrad, Censori spent 4 years working at what she calls a normie architecture firm, where she discovered being an architect was less about creating monuments to genius ideas as it is filing for permits to install the correct number of toilets. She was finishing her thesis in 2020 when the general manager of Yeezy reached out because Ye had seen an image Censori had posted to Instagram. Not a nude selfie, but a digital mask with alien proportions. Censori sent back her portfolio, and she met Ye in Switzerland in the middle of the pandemic. He offered her a job as head of architecture in Los Angeles, where she fell in with a group of fashion and art world people, including Gadir Rajab, a stylist who would begin styling and photographing Censori, and Leo Becerra, the director of Biopop, and witness to the early days of Censori's nudity project, when she started sourcing barely clothes from dance stores and sex shops. She was always laughing, always dancing, Becerra says. At Yeezy, Ye and Censori began to iterate. Most of what they worked on was never realized, including more developed versions of the mound-like structures Ye built on his Calabasas, California property in 2019 with the intention of revolutionizing sustainable housing. Censori was also involved with the renovation of a Malibu home built by the Pritzker Prize-winning architect Tadeo Ando, which Ye bought in 2021 for $57.3 million and subsequently gutted. Though this was widely considered to be an architectural sin, A representative for Ondo told The New Yorker he does not like to talk much about it, since Sori feels absolved. She'd been trying to help make a home on a small oceanfront footprint feel as grand as Ondo's work deserved. In so doing, Sensori and Ye ruined it to her glee. Ondo did not respond to Vanity Fair. The house was red-taped and sold at a reported eight-figure loss. When I suggest that her passion for housing security seems at odds with construction waste and moldering remnants, Sensori says rehoming people to a beachfront property in Malibu is a way of controlling them. My husband and I had worked on affordable housing also, but I feel so strongly about the topic that I don't believe it is right to rehouse people in a place that you choose to rehouse them. Affordable housing is not actually a housing issue. The other systems need to uplift the individual so they are able to have autonomy and make choices. I don't think it's okay to say like, oh, you can't get a house? Let me get you a house, but let me put you in that place. The thing about destruction is it gives life to something else, Sensori says. So when I would enter that house that was quote-unquote destroyed, bats were living inside of it, and the sea salt had taken over the steel that was in the house and was rusting. A tree is the shape of a tree because that's what nature does or whatever, Sensori says. What does a house want to be? And that, I feel, will be my life's work. The couple's new home in Beverly Hills is the subject of an HOA dispute with their more architecturally conservative neighbors. It was built in the 2000s, but it looks like someone was like, hey, have you seen that movie Blow? That's what I want, an 80s cocaine house, Sensori says. Anytime anyone comes over, I'm like, do not look at the house. Sensori also liked that an expression of ego, this supposed Malibu masterpiece, was being used in a way that hadn't been intended. They have this idea of, okay, once I have this home and I've handed it off to the client, it has to remain the same way as when I passed it off, Sensori says of architects. But that's not how people use space. I think that the destruction of the home was beautiful to me, and I think symbolic also of that time. The year Ye purchased the house, Kim Kardashian filed for divorce, a decision she subsequently attributed partially to his mental breaks, which were reported, self-documented, and frequently made into music. Around the same general period, Sensori and Ye were falling in love. Proximity, Sensori offers by way of explanation, just working together. You're spending so much time with somebody. So we'd be either on the phone together or with each other all the time. His aura both overpowered her and complemented her own. You've got to see it, Sensori says of his magnetism. We're so similar. Suddenly, Sensori was experiencing what her producer Ted Lawson calls the banality of extravagance. When you're in the bubble Ye is in, it's ubiquitous. Sensori joined a kind of chaotic privilege, captured in the 2025 documentary of Ye, In Whose Name? The doc was made over 6 years and comprised footage shot by Nico Ballesteros, to whom Ye gave seemingly complete access, letting the young stranger film him for more than half a decade. Despite her inability to moderate in personal relationships, Sensori does not make herself seem like an obvious fit for this environment with her rigorous restraint, in her academic and artistic pursuits, in her stringent silence. However, Lawson says, she's completely natural there, amazingly. It doesn't faze her, in my view. You know, it's normal reality. As an entity, she already has a kind of iconic vibe and a sense of herself, and whether people understand what that means or not doesn't matter. I didn't marry my husband because I wanted some sort of platform, Sensori says. I married him because I love him. Is that like the corniest thing ever? Sensori may not have wanted a platform, but now that she had one, she was going to stand on it naked. She understands that no one would be interested in her if she weren't what she calls a nepo wife, like, I'm famous by association. But your image is replicated without your consent all the time. It's replicated, it's brought down, it's picked apart, all those kind of things. The public perception seemed to be that Sensori was a mute captive being trafficked in daylight and dressed by her husband like a sex doll, a narrative that was not aided by the Venice incident. I ask if she knows what people thought happened in the water taxi. Yes, she says. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. You can also ask your smart speaker to play North Carolina Reading Service. Opening and closing music by Calexico, Interval Selection by Mark Hoffman.